May it please the court. My name is Robert Bruce, and along with Dan Doyle, I represent the relator in this matter, Cynthia Shaparo. This case presents the odd intersection of two familiar topics for this court, forced arbitration and Chapter 287, Missouri's workers' compensation law. The precise question asked by this case is who determines which rights can be waived that arise under Chapter 287, the General Assembly through Section 287.390, or private employers through the use of arbitration agreements. Relator respectfully requests that this court make permanent its preliminary writ of mandamus, thereby holding that Section 287.390 does not allow an employee to waive any right arising under Chapter 287.
Why is that necessary, Counselor? Hasn't the court vacated its previous order and allowed that claim to go to trial?
Your Honor, there is a stay at the circuit court level. The circuit court case is open as far as the 287 claim. However, it's not proceeding until this court makes permanent its preliminary writ.
I'm looking at an order dated December 22, 2017, in which the circuit court, Judge Young's entered an order stating that his previous order forcing or requiring arbitration on the 287.780 claim is vacated and set aside.
And it says, in lieu thereof, the amended order is hereby modified to allow plaintiff's 287.780 claim to proceed in circuit court.
That's correct, Your Honor. And then Judge Young has stayed all proceedings pending what happens in this matter.
Why should the preliminary order even be in effect since he's vacated that order?
Your Honor, right now Judge Young is still not allowing relator in this case to go forward in circuit court on that claim. Basically, until the preliminary writ is made permanent, the proceedings have froze, for lack of a better
term. But the current order is in your favor, is that correct?
That is correct.
So isn't what you brought here moot?
Asking for the preliminary writ to be made permanent?
Well, I mean, right now the last order says it'll proceed in court. Is that correct?
That is correct. But
isn't that your argument? Is it should proceed in court?
That is what should happen. Yes. What the preliminary writ has instructed is what we are requesting. The trial proceedings have been stayed, though.
I think you feel that he did that in reaction to our writ.
Correct.
And that once, if we were to quash the writ because of that, he would then do something different rather than letting it proceed in circuit court.
Exactly. He's paused the proceedings looking to this court to see if the writ is going to be made permanent or quashed. And then he'll react either going forward or stay.
Okay.
Chapter 287 grants a civil action for damages. And inherent in a civil action for damages, as defined in common law, was the right to a trial by jury. Section 287.390 is an enforcement mechanism unique to Chapter 287, which prevents an employee from waiving any rights which arise under the chapter. Specifically, the statute reads, no agreement by an employee or his or her dependents to waive his or her rights under this chapter shall be valid. Three maxims of statutory construction dictate that those words mean precisely what they say. The first is the court will not resort to any canons of construction unless the statute is ambiguous. And these words, rights under this chapter, are not ambiguous. They mean every right arising under Chapter 287, including the right to a jury trial inherent in the civil action for damages.
But the workers' comp statute doesn't give your client the right to a jury trial. It just gives your client the right to a claim.
That's correct. It gives you a right to a civil action for damages. And
even
when that
your client still has a civil action for damages, it just is the original order of the court at least ordered that claim be brought to arbitration.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, this court has stated in State v. Duger that when words have a definite and well-known meaning at common law, they will be presumed to be understood in the sense in which they were defined at common law. And at common law, and certainly in 1973 when that statute was amended, a civil action for damages referred to a specific bundle of rights, one of which was the right to a trial by jury.
Well, and this court held the MHRA, which created a right for damages, didn't mention a jury trial necessarily implicitly within it, had a right to jury trial because under Missouri's Constitution in 1820, civil actions for damages did have, were you were entitled to a jury to those. Therefore, it's implicit in any action for damages that you have a right to jury trial.
Precisely,
Your Honor. Even if it's a statutory cause of action.
Precisely. And in O'Malley, the way this court defined it was the simple analysis is whether or not it's a civil action for damages. And if it is, the right to a jury trial exists. Therefore, by using civil action for damages, the General Assembly was using a term that was well-defined and well-known at common law and included a right to a trial by jury. And in fact, they've used that term several times, almost once per decade, since the amendment in 1973 to this act, including once in 2017. Further, this court in Cook v. Hussman interpreted the interplay of Section 287.390 and 287.780. Specifically, this court held that the rights protected by Section 287.780 cannot be bargained away. This court went on to write that the plain intent of the statute, Section 287.390, is to preserve the cause of action granted by 287.780.
But in Cook, isn't it true, though, that it barred the action completely? So the circuit court in Cook dismissed the claim completely. And in this case, at least you have a claim. Your client has a claim. It just doesn't have a claim that under the court's original order that could be brought to a jury.
That's correct. The client has essentially been allowed to waive a right arising under Chapter 287, which is precisely what Section 287.390 does not allow. She certainly still has a large amount of those bundle of rights, and they could be vindicated. That claim could be vindicated in arbitration. However, in direct violation of 287.390, she's been allowed to waive a right arising under the chapter. And because the statute's intent is clear, and Cook clearly shows that this court has interpreted 287.390 to apply to all rights arising under Chapter 287, including each and every right in the bundle of rights included in civil action, that is improper under the statute. And further, Cook was decided in 1993, and despite being on the books for over a quarter of a century, the General Assembly has not reacted to that at all. And that's quite remarkable considering how often the General Assembly amends and changes Chapter 287, particularly in response to decisions by this court, the Court of Appeals, and even the Labor and Industrial Relations Commission. Instead, despite being on notice, the General Assembly has let that analysis stand. And that shows how the General Assembly approves of that. And it approves of the scheme of Chapter 287, that employees and employers can't pick and choose which rights are going to apply to their employment contracts. It's an all-or-nothing scheme. Otherwise, the entire system may fall apart. It only works if everyone plays by the rules, and the General Assembly is the body that sets those rules. Further, the Federal Arbitration Act does not preempt Section 287.390. Both this court and the United States Supreme Court have repeatedly held that all the Federal Arbitration Act does is place arbitration agreements on equal footing with other contracts. Therefore, it will preempt two types of defenses. One is a defense that applies only to arbitration, and the second is a defense that derives its meaning from the fact that an agreement to arbitrate is at issue. The first type of defense is not at play here. Arbitration is not mentioned at all in the statute. It speaks in terms of rights arising under Chapter 287. The second prong is also not in effect here. The fact that this contract is before the court isn't derived from the fact that it's arbitration. It's because it's an attempt to waive a right arising under 287. I think a hypothetical is the best way to see that. If the contract here purported to set relators' average weekly wage at $100 an hour rather than being determined by the average of the 13 weeks before her injury, if it sought to cap her medical expenses, sought to waive her right to physical rehabilitation under the Act, any Missouri court would strike that contract down for being in violation of 287.390. Only because the specific right here is a right to jury trial is the Federal Arbitration Act implicated. But that's not placing arbitration contracts on equal footing. It's placing them on elevated footing. And neither this court nor the Supreme Court has ever held that that is what the Federal Arbitration Act requires. And holding so would invalidate the savings clause of Section 2 that states that arbitration agreements can be invalidated by by laws that apply to all contracts, including state law defenses. Further, Your Honor, the 287.390, like the rest of Chapter 287, must be strictly construed. And that just cements what Cook said, that that plain language can only mean what this court said it means in Cook, that 287.390 applies to the civil action for damages that arises, including each and every one of those rights. If the court has no further...
Could I revisit your interpretation of Judge Young's order? What causes you to interpret the statement in his order, no further action shall be taken by this court pending further order of the Missouri Supreme Court?
Basically, if we were to file anything, discovery...
The reason I ask that is because that he is repeating what the court's order told him, that he could take no further action other than to vacate it. And you've said, well, he's waiting to see what the stay is, and if we don't make what the ruling is, and if we don't make the writ permanent, he will reverse that order. Is there anything in your communications with him that indicates that, or is that simply your interpretation of that statement?
There's been discussion with the court regarding how that's being interpreted, and the way that relator is interpreted, and I can't speak for opposing counsel, but I believe that was the understanding on all parts, is that no action would be taken. So if discovery was attempted to be propounded, there's no way to force compliance with that because court is not.
No, I accept that it says it stayed. My question is, what causes you to believe he would vacate that order and reinstate his prior order?
If the court dismissed today,
I believe that he would do so because the court would remove that mandate and say essentially that respondent was correct in his first order.
No, why would we? If we dismiss something, why would we be saying something was correct? Then that doesn't have any merits holding.
I see. If you're saying
our concern is that he now has an order in effect that gives you everything you asked for, and you're saying, well, that's only tentative because he's trying to put us in the status quo ante. I think you're saying, but is there something that makes that clear? Because we can't tell from this order. It appears he changed his mind and ruled the other way, which would moot the controversy. But if he's simply saying I'm going to keep it here until the court rules, that's a different matter and it's not moot. How do we know which it is?
Your Honor, I understand the confusion. I don't know of anything that directly states that there would be no action taken. I will say this has been transferred by administrative order to a different judge at this point and is awaiting a case management conference after this argument. Thank you.
May it please the court. If I may address the procedural issue that the court is wrestling with, it is our understanding that the circuit court has in fact stayed all proceedings. The court had in fact set a routine case management conference, and when we brought to the attention that this matter was pending before this court, the court removed the case management conference. And
no, the court understands the stay. That's not the question. That's sub 3. Sub 2 says, in lieu thereof, the amended order is hereby modified to allow plaintiff section 287.780 claim to proceed in circuit court. Does that mean you lost and your opposing counsel won and there's no issue before us?
I don't believe so, Judge. I believe that the circuit court clearly understands, at least that's what its indication to us, through the failure or the refusal to set a case management conference or proceed in any other manner pending this court's ruling, the circuit court's awaiting this decision.
I guess, in fairness, some of our language in our preliminary writs are a little confusing to follow, but clearly what the preliminary writ says is that the circuit court should take no action other than vacating its original order. If it vacates its original order, then it can take action. So it seems to me that where plaintiff or whoever wants to proceed here should seek a writ ordering the court to proceed and lift the stay because they've followed the order.
I think that, Judge, that would merely kick the can down the road because it's my belief that if the court were to go ahead and proceed with the case and we bring this issue back before the court, I believe, will go ahead and issue a stay of the proceedings, and we'll have to restart this process again to have this issue.
It sounds like both of you are saying the court understood our order to say this is what it was supposed to do until we ruled.
That's That's correct, Judge. I believe the court is awaiting ruling on the issue that is on the merits that is before the court.
But do you see our concern is if we enter a ruling on the merits, could someone come back later and say that ruling was moot because the judge had already done what it had ordered it to do in the preliminary writ?
Well, luckily, it's only us who could say that.
Couldn't have said it better myself. I think certainly this court has the power with regard to the nature of the procedural proceedings to go ahead and take up the issue on the merits and rule on it and decide whether or not this case.
Well, you're suggesting we should quash the writ and tell you why we quashed it? I mean, normally, you know, when we decide cases on the merits in a writ proceeding, we make the writ permanent. What is there to make permanent in this case?
I believe on the merits, the court should decide that the writ was improper and quash the writ and remand the case for further proceedings consistent with the trial court's original decision.
But that decision doesn't exist anymore.
No, you want a writ ordering the court to change its mind back.
Yes.
And you're not the relator, so you don't get a writ. Okay, that's the problem. We're arguing about an issue that solved itself, and we don't do that in the context of original proceedings.
But you're both saying it's just that the court just misunderstood what it was supposed to do, and it's going to be right back up here, so please treat it like he's just saying it's staying here in circuit court until this court rules, not that he's changed his mind or readdressed the original issue that divided you.
That's exactly what we're saying.
Well, yeah. And the he here has changed as well. Before we indulge in too much prognostication about what Judge Youngs would do, he's no longer the trial judge. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so we haven't. Now we're prognosticating about a different judge's future orders.
Presumably so, Judge.
Except we do have an order from the old judge to the new judge that presumably the new judge may follow.
Presumably, although he hasn't. So, for example, the new judge said a case management conference is a matter of course. When we brought this issue to the trial court's attention, the new judge removed the case management conference and is awaiting further instructions from this court.
So, and I know you'd like to get to the merits on this, but I'm also confused. I'm also confused that from review of the case net, it looked like it got set for trial in May, and the case would have gone to trial in May, but for the issues with the transfer and the arguments over the transfer. And so to me, I didn't get the impression by reviewing CaseNet that I assumed the case was getting ready to go to trial.
No, Judge, there's been zero activity on this case since this court taking this case and issuing preliminary writ.
That's consistent with our order that no action be taken other than to set aside the prior order.
That's right, Judge.
Yeah, so until we would find the case moot and vacate that order or quash that, then the court was behaving properly.
That's exactly what we believe, and I think that's consistent with my opposing counsel's understanding of what the court's done
but
as well.
But if we quash the preliminary writ, then we would be leaving in effect the order that was entered consistent with the directive of that preliminary writ.
Although if the court were to quash the preliminary writ with a holding that the arbitration agreement is valid and that the workers' comp retaliation claim should proceed to arbitration as agreed to by the parties, the circuit court would then have a mandate that would drive its future decisions.
Sure, if we reach the merits, we're just trying to figure out the effect. Is there some? There are other claims. Are they proceeding in arbitration or in circuit court?
No, they're in arbitration, actively in arbitration. Okay. There's an arbitrator that's been selected. A scheduling order has been entered, and the hearing date's been set.
Okay.
And we're proceeding in discovery on that split claim.
Okay. You maybe could turn to the merits.
Well. Let me just...
Unless we interrupt you again.
Yeah, you know, that's okay, and I'm a little short of time, so let me see if I can be quicker than I normally would be. I think there are two issues that I'd like the court to think about on the merits. The first is that nothing in U-Haul's arbitration agreement with Ms. Chaparro waives any right provided under Chapter 287. She has intact her right to bring her civil action for damages. It's in the arbitrable forum. The second point that requires some attention from the court...
You don't think civil action for damages is almost universally understood to mean in court?
Well, if it were, Judge, we wouldn't have to have had, for example, Deal versus O'Malley. And there's some specific language in that case that I'd like to draw the court's attention to. Because that case was whether or not Of course, the court knows what that case is about. The language in the case is that it says that, Section 287.780 is subject to Section 22A of the Constitution. That there's no bundle of rights. There's that term is used in the context of takings clauses under Missouri law. There's no bundle of rights otherwise. And that we have to construe this contract, this statute, strictly. The court knows that under 287.800. And so when we construe something strictly, a strict construction of the statute presumes nothing that is not expressed. And that begs the question, where within the Workers' Comp Act is there a right to a jury trial expressed?
But Deal said there's nothing in the Missouri Human Rights Act that says you have a right to a jury trial. But we said it's implicit in that you have a right to damages because under the 1820 Constitution, the right you have preserves the right to jury trial is heretofore known, and that was in all cases involving damages.
2 points. One, the court, I believe, doesn't say it's implicit. It says that the right to a jury trial for damages arises under Section 22A of the Constitution. That's what triggers the right to the jury trial. Secondly, and this is an important nuance, which is the MHRA was recently amended. And if we look at 211.111.3, it expressly states now that there is a right to a trial by jury. That's in contrast to 287.780, which was recently amended, and doesn't speak to the right to a jury trial. So that the legislature purposely did not bring into 287.780 the right to a jury trial, instead leaving intact merely the phrase, the right to a civil action for damages.
But your Deal did say there's a right to a jury trial.
Certainly it does, but that question in Deal was whether or not that right to a jury trial, when there is a civil action for damages, arises under the Constitution. That's what triggered the right to the jury trial. Here, when we strictly construed 287.390.1, and it says any rights under this chapter, the right provided under this chapter is the right to a civil action for damages, begging the question, what does that term mean? Because the statute certainly doesn't define what a civil action for damages is, and Missouri law is clear that when there's no definition in a statute, we turn to the plain and ordinary meaning, and looking at dictionaries, for example. And when we turn to look at the plain and ordinary meaning of what a civil action is in Missouri, and we look at, for example, the dictionary definitions, we see that it's an action to brought to enforce, redress, or protect a private or civil right. And that is exactly what this arbitration agreement provides. Ms. Chaparro has fully intact her right to bring a civil action for damages. It's in the arbitrable and not to the the judicial forum. Nothing in the arbitration agreement.
And you're saying, is your argument dependent on our agreeing that the term civil action for damages means arbitration or can mean arbitration?
It doesn't matter. The term civil action, if we look, for example, the only case that has addressed what 287.780 means is the Templemeyer case in this context. And in Templemeyer, the court used the term that 287.780 is a, quote, private right of action. It says that it's a private cause of action, right? It's a private cause of action. And that term, a private cause of action under Missouri law, in the Chesterfield Village versus City of Chesterfield case, 64 Southwest 3rd, 315, defines a cause of action as a group of operative facts giving rise to one or more bases for suing. That is fully intact here. Ms. Chaparro has the ability to bring the arbitrable forum her cause of action, her civil action, seeking damages, which the arbitrator is not in any way limited from providing, in which she can allege a group of operative facts giving rise to one or more bases for suing. But let me turn in my limited time to the second important issue. And the second issue is that to the extent that this court construes 287.390.1 to render the arbitration agreement as void, that would run afoul of the Supremacy Clause and the U.S. Supreme Court's mandate in Southland Corporation versus Keating at 465 U.S. 1, and which was cited in the Bungie Corp versus Perryville Feed case decided by this court, 685 Southwest 2nd, 837. And in the Southland case, the Supreme Court was examining the extent to which a California statute, which rendered a provision void, was an impermissible obstacle to arbitration and would otherwise violate the supremacy clause. In Southland, the statute itself said that any condition, stipulation, or provision purporting to bind any person acquiring any franchise to waive compliance with any provision of this law or any rule or order hereunder is void. It's very similar to the language in our statute that we're looking here. And what the Supreme Court said is that it's a manifest violation of the Supremacy Clause if our statute is applied to impose a requirement which is in addition to the requirements of the Federal Arbitration Act. Any requirement of state law which adds a burden not imposed by Congress in derogation of the congressional power is pro tanto invalid.
But there are exceptions for any, as long as you apply state, my understanding is as long as you treat this provision of a contract like any other provision of a contract under state law, then it would be valid. And opposing counsel's argument is that that's what's occurring here, that you can't waive any rights, and this is simply one of the many rights given under the Workers' Comp Act. How do you respond to that part of their argument?
I point to Southland Corporation and stand on it, Your Honor, in which Southland Corporation addressed that very question.
So can you address their argument that then you're treating arbitration clauses differently because they uniquely can waive the right to jury trial or to a civil action, but you can't waive any other rights?
To the extent the state law, the state statute is being used to foreclose an attempt to enforce arbitration, that is a violation of the Supremacy Clause. And we can see that at page 861 of Keating, at 461 at 861, where the court held, the U.S. Supreme Court held, in creating a substantive rule applicable in state as well as federal courts, Congress intended to foreclose state legislative attempts to undercut the enforceability of arbitration agreements. And applying facts that are, if not identical, or closely analogous, where the plaintiff seeking to avoid the effect of arbitration was relying on a provision under state law to void the contract or render it void. The court held that in that context, applying the state statute in that way has the effect of infringing upon the Federal Arbitration Act supremacy. And that would be no different here. I hope that the court will address the merits of this issue. And certainly I believe that the court will require Ms. Shapiro, as the parties intended, to arbitrate her claim. We have an arbitration pending. The arbitrator is awaiting instructions from this court. We can have the arbitrator hear the merits of this case, and Ms. Shapiro can be provided the full extent of the substantive remedy and the substantive cause of action afforded under Chapter 287. And I'd ask the court to go ahead and hear this case and issue a mandate that requires Ms. Shapiro to compel her workers' comp retaliation case to arbitration.
Are you arguing that she could not file her civil action or her action in the state court, or are you arguing she could file it but it had to be stayed then and sent to arbitration?
I'm sorry, Judge.
Are you arguing that she had to immediately go to arbitration, or are you arguing that she could file her action but then the trial court could stay it and send her to arbitration?
Well, we see that all the time. The plaintiffs file their action in state court, see whether or not the opposing party chooses to enforce the arbitration agreement. There may be circumstances in which a party to an arbitration agreement may choose not to invoke its rights under the arbitration agreement. So certainly Ms. Chopra had the right to file the lawsuit, but then she had the coextensive right to then submit her claim to arbitration when U-Haul insisted that she honor the terms of the contract that they entered into.
Thank you.
I want to go back again. Indulge me for a second. What relief are you asking for? Because if we quash the writ, the preliminary writ, his amended order, Judge Young's amended order is in place. And so then the claim's going to proceed in circuit court.
I'm asking that the court hold that the arbitration agreement is enforceable and that nothing in the arbitration agreement waives any rights that Ms. Chapiro has under Chapter 287. With that holding, the court will avoid the problem triggered by the Supremacy Clause and issue a mandate that will compel the circuit court to order arbitration on the entirety of Ms. Chapiro's claims.
Would you be opposed to our asking the trial court to clarify the procedural posture of this case?
I don't know why that's necessary, but to the extent that the court, I'm not going to be so arrogant to suggest that what this court should or should not do in that regard.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
If the court has any additional questions, I'll do my best to attempt to answer them. Otherwise, we would just ask that, based upon the merits of this action, the preliminary writ be made permanent.
Your interpretation of 287.780 is that, and the other statute is that they cannot waive their right to a jury trial. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So if in fact they had a jury trial, no one asked for arbitration agreement to be enforced, then they couldn't have a bench strike case. They would have to have a jury trial.
Your Honor, I think there's a distinction, and this distinction is noted in our brief in footnote 3, I believe. The federal courts have dealt with a similar issue under FMLA leave. There's a difference between a right and whenever that right materializes into a claim. Once someone has the claim, they've been discriminated against, they have this claim before them, they're free to not prosecute it. They're free to waive any and all rights to submit it to arbitration. But that decision has to be made at the time that the claim has arisen.
They can't, by contract, prior to the time a claim arises, waive it before it exists.
Exactly, based upon 287.390, that it speaks in terms of rights. And actually looking to the first of that section, it shows the General Assembly sort of adopted that philosophy. It says parties to claims hereunder may enter into voluntary agreements, etc. It then goes on to speak in terms of rights that cannot be waived. I believe that's the distinction. So it is possible to submit a 287.780 claim to arbitration so long as that decision is made after the claim has arisen, not whenever it's a preemptively waived right. And that makes sense looking at the purpose of 287.390. The General Assembly doesn't want workers, particularly workers such as Ms. Shaparo, unskilled laborers who read at a third grade level, to try to make themselves more appealable to employers by saying, you don't have to give me work comp rights. We're all sort of optimists and we think we won't get hurt at work, it won't even matter, so I'll waive that right to become more appealable, more employable. The General Assembly thought about this, and that's why that enforcement mechanism is in place. Therefore, relators simply ask that this court, if it chooses to address the merits of this case, make permanent its preliminary writ. Your Honors, I thank you for your time.
Thank you.